Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Patrick, baby, one thing I really do need, your list to some really good games. Patrick, baby, hurry down the chimney tonight. This is the last podcast that I'm doing for Waypoint this year. I'm just leaving it all on the field. I'm letting the flag fly.
Rob, I didn't even bring a top 10 list of games. Number 10, I'd like to talk about Eddie Goldman. Nose tackles, underappreciated on the defensive line.
Look, we sent five guys to the Pro Bowl. I think we could have sent more. I think more people, if they were watching this team, they know there's more. Like, there's a lot of people who are going to the Pro Bowl don't deserve to be there.
No. And you know,
is Aaron Rodgers a Pro Bowl quarterback this year? Really?
He's barely got a leg. Press Callahan, you should be going. Got injured, not being on this. Anyway, yeah, okay. I think we actually killed Cotto. I think he might actually.
Oh, yeah. Was the chimney thing Cotto? Might have been the chimney thing. God, it's a filthy song.
This is it, right? This is it. This is the last podcast that I got to do. I got to actually I got to write my top 10 list. I'll probably end up like figuring out some thoughts here in this conversation, but I got to do edits on my essay, but like I can see the sprint. I'm in the final sprint here. I can see the end.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure when this is going up, but we're in the middle of our final week of working Waypoint for this year before vacations begin. So this is the very last thing we are recording. I have been recording podcasts probably. This is what, hour 12, hour 16 this week,
sure,
of podcasts. Yeah. That's how it feels. But anyway, so we've been doing these one-on-one conversations this year to sort of work through our personal top 10, sort of our highs and highlights of the year. And I think this is actually going to be the last of these you've heard. So you will have heard Austin and Natalie, Danielle and Cotto, and now it's time for me and Patrick to sort of work through our feelings and talk about some of the unlikely overlap we have, but then also some of the really novel experiences we've had this year that we really treasure. So, Patrick, let's just dive into this.
I have not had time to actually. So I gave you 10 games. You gave me 40 games.
Yes. Look, I love games. That's just something I need to put out there right now. I really love video games, and it's hard to choose just 10. I think it's an arbitrary bullshit number.
That's fair. I gave you 10 because I haven't had time to actually rank them and figure out where I fall on, like, what is my favorite game of the year. I don't know. Do you want to just pluck one from my top 10, and we'll just go from there?
Yeah, all right. So let's start with Mutant Year Zero, because this is one I just didn't even consider for this year. I was like, sorry, you came out in December, your tactics game, I can't process you right now. Like, I will deal with you, I will talk about you next year. But this is actually sort of rocketed onto your charts.
Yeah, I've now put 14 hours into the game. I'm most of the way through. I believe I've opened up I've heard it's a relatively short game for at least games of this type. If that is true, then the map that I have opened, I believe I have like the last couple of areas outside of going to like high level spots that are meant for probably end game play if you want to get like the very best loot that the game has to offer. December often hides like one or two games that ends up becoming maybe a game on your 2019 list or a game in January where you go, if I'd only had time to really invest in this game, maybe it would have landed here. And so I know the two games I wanted to try before the end of the year was this, because honestly, like there were write-ups so glowing about it that very much projected it as, hey, if you like XCOM, but like want a little more like character work and story, this could be for you. And that like really sounded up my alley. And it was like that and Ashen. And basically the way I was going to figure was like, all right, I'm going to give these games 90 minutes each. And then if one grabs me, I'm going to try and, rather than try and dip into a million different things, I'm going to try and pick one, go down that lane and see where I land in it. And played 90 minutes of Ashen, liked it well enough. I will go back and I will fully play that game throughout the rest of the month and into January. But I played 5 minutes of this game and it just utterly captured and charmed me. And the more time I've spent with it, it has just enough depth that I don't get too lost in it. As someone that is, more on the Danielle side of like baby tactics, in which I've found games that I've had success with, I've found games that I have enjoyed, but I get often intimidated by the scale and depth that a lot of those games require, or like that's part of the appeal. This is very much in the Fire Emblem, XCOM sort of mold, and absolutely does have the characters, the world, this charm that I have, has just utterly captivated me. And like, even just the way, like, even though it's a fairly shortish game, like it's always by design of that, every couple of hours, like they introduce a new character that has like fundamentally different abilities that like, of course, like conveniently times with, you know, an encounter you may be having. Like I just had a sequence last night where I've occasionally run into robots, but it's usually just a med bot, which can revive enemies on the field. But this time I came across, I think it's called like Metal City, which is just like an abandoned android factory. And so there were just all of these different robots, no human life whatsoever. But you come across a character who has a weapon that has a damage perk that can be attached to it that does a 50-50 chance to disable a robot for 3 turns. And so suddenly I didn't realize I had that ability, and so I wasn't using that weapon. So the fight was insurmountable for like a good hour until I realized, okay, like what am I not picking up here? Dove into that. All of a sudden it made it not quite a quake walk, but I understood the strategy I was trying to employ by turning them into a sniper. And just, I could go on and on about this game, but I just, even though I haven't finished it, I know I'm already in love, and now it's just a matter of like, where do I slot that? And it's been fun to genuinely have a game at the last second, like so surprised me that I felt the need to knock Florence, which was the game that was in its place in the list. An utterly also a charming and touching short story about relationships, especially ones often in your 20s where you're learning about yourself and having to realize that sometimes relationships are just a moment in time to learn from later. That game got fucking booted so that a talking Porky Pig and Donald the Duck could go out and shoot ghouls in the waste.
In that campaign, by the way, like, do you have any decisions you're making, or is it mostly just like the story unfolds and then you get a mission? It's like Valkyria Chronicles-esque, really, where there's not too many branch points that you have to face. There's not too much customization you can do.
No, it's really limited. I mean, that has been probably part of the reason I've been able to get into it as fast as I've been able to get into it, and part of why I latched onto it as hard as it did, because there isn't a lot to it. That's not to say there isn't a lot to it, but it's just that like the amount of just variables that you're playing with at any one time are limited in a way that I found appealing and also allowed me to get into it relatively quickly. Yeah, you're not making story decisions. I mean, the story is fine. I'm actually more interested in the world and characters than I am in the actual story beats. There's not a whole lot to that in this game. Yeah. But there's enough that make the encounters mean a little bit more. There's enough that I am looking forward to, you know, what is around the corner rather than just what is the specific, you know, tactical setup that's going to force me to rethink, you know, how I'm going to set up my characters. So it's, yeah, I think you will love it. I think you will also really enjoy it. I definitely recommend it. But that's the one that, of my list, is the one that snuck it snuck itself the hell on in a way that I was not prepared for. Did you have one like that on your list, or is yours more of a totality of 2019 in general?
No, definitely I had something sort of catch me off guard at the end of the year, which is a game called Armored Brigade by Vitica Studios. And we talked about it on Three Moves Ahead the other week. We had Rod Humble on. But this is weird because it's almost like a really indie war game. And it's experimental and weird in some ways. Like, if you look it up, Patrick, what you're going to see is going to look pretty unparsable. It's going to look like some Rob Zachney bullshit, to be quite honest.
A lot of menus?
There's a lot of really crude-looking, hard to understand menus. But if you get past that, the weird thing about Armored Brigade is... It is a war game.
Yeah, okay. You were. Yeah.
So this comes out like in like mid late November, and basically it's a war game where like there's no like there's some set scenarios, but mostly what you're supposed to do in this game is you build your own scenarios and you fight them. And the way they've set that up is so like you'll get a map of like the Fulda Gap, which is where for years NATO planners figured that if the Red Army was going to cross into NATO territory in the 80s, they would do it in the Fulda Gap. It was just the right terrain for a large scale armored assault. So there's this map of the entire like Fulda region in Germany. And for you to create your scenario, you basically just like drag, you like click and drag a box around the part of that territory that you want to be your board, and then you say like, oh yeah, I want to be a German mechanized battalion defending from a Red Army armored division would be pretty cool. Let's see what that looks like. And you generate like an entire skirmish out of that. And you can customize it a lot of different ways. You can decide, you can move around like where the objectives are and all this stuff. But it ends up, for one thing, the AI can actually like parse that. Like,
I was going to say, that seems like the thing that I'd be worried about the most is like, oh, it's cool that it's a creative tool set. But part of the reason that stuff is, you know, hand curated and structured and scripted in the first place is to make sure that, you know, things go play out a certain way. And so my main worry would be that like, oh, create to your heart's content, but you know, in the actual playing part, it's a little muddled.
Yeah. And instead the AI behaves like a really clever opponent and in ways that really catch me off guard, but also generate some really dramatic moments. Because like with a lot of games like this, you play them, you're playing scenarios and they're sort of pre-rolled scenarios. They have a certain dynamic built in. Like there's kind of an arc the designer had in mind that this scenario would follow. Every Armored Brigade fight, it feels like any fucking thing could happen at any moment. You don't know what the AI did. Like you picked your side, but all you know is it's a Soviet armored division. But all that means is the computer was handed like a basket of buy points that it had to allocate in a certain way, but it could have still bought anything off those menus. So you fundamentally, like, you don't know what you're up against. It could be anything. And so every scenario you're sitting there and like, you really are like the minute a recon unit like gets eyes on an old Soviet T-64, which was like two generations behind what was cutting edge in the 80s. The minute you realize that you've got your like best tanks reacting to an armored attack that is basically going to do nothing, like they're shitty Soviet tanks, is when you realize like, oh, if the bad Soviet tanks are over here, where are the good ones? I just fucked up. I have been baited out of position because like all I knew was tanks were coming down this road. Now I have good intel. And it turns out I might be responding to a diversion.
Interesting. Does the game like set up, like, can you just set up like totally unwinnable scenario? Like, do you get any warning? Like, how does it, like, does it try to funnel you into, yes, like, hey, we want to make sure that like this is something that you can enjoy or finish? Like, how does it handle that aspect?
It provides some guardrails. Okay. So like you can, like, basically it will tell you for a given scenario, if the defender has 100% point values, don't worry about the point percentages too much, but the defender has 100%, it recommends that for this to be a fun and balanced scenario, the attacker should probably have like 130%. So it should be like a 1.3 to 1 advantage that the attacker has. And it will tell you, like, if you begin skewing that too far one way or the other, it's kind of like highlighting the degree to which you are making this unbalanced.
Right.
So it, that's the other thing is, like, I think this would suck, Patrick. You're right. And this is what I thought would happen. I thought there would be a lot of ways you could fuck up and create not fun scenarios. That's what usually happens with, like, dynamic procedural content. You provide a lot of, like, bland garbage.
Right.
And all that matters is that there's an infinite amount of it. This game is some of the most tense, like, white-knuckle shit I've done all year, dude. Like, to give you a sense of a story, and this is what I was, like, I'm trying to get Austin on this game. I'm not sure it's going to take, but to give you a sense of like a thing that happens in this game. So I have this infantry platoon with eight like armored personnel carriers backing them up, but they're all dug into this forest, watching this road north of this like crucial town, and they're all ranged in a long line. And one squad is like deeper in the forest than the others. The others are sort of closer to the town and the road. And as the Soviet assault begins, the first squads to get line of sight begin opening fire with anti-tank missiles. And they just start fucking laying waste to like the leading Soviet units. And I'm like, great, this is awesome. These guys are kicking ass. And the Soviets stop coming. The AI just sort of backs off. And I'm like, cool, we drove them off. And then a few artillery rounds start falling on the position, but it's like not too bad. Like we're talking like this is all real time. So like the Soviets back off. Like 60 seconds later, a few artillery shells start falling in. And it's not too accurate. Like it takes some light casualties. I'm like, well, that wasn't so bad. They must not really know where I'm at. Turns out that's ranging fire. And those shells were just test shots that the spotters were using to zero in where the main barrage should fall. And so I'm like, cool, I guess I got through that just fine. And a second later, just all hell breaks loose. We're talking like cluster munitions dropping on this woods. The woods catch fire. The terrain is super destructible. It's just absolute carnage. And everyone basically gets slaughtered. Like the thing I should have done is realize these guys need to get pulled out. They've exposed their position. They're going to get killed. Everyone gets slaughtered except one squad that's deep in the woods, and they realize that like they're completely alone, and they're the only ones left to guard this town that was really critical to hold. I just need them to delay whatever is coming up that road. So all their comrades have basically been wiped out. Here's the other thing, Patrick. There's order delays. There's a chain of command. If their command post was destroyed, they like these guys are still exist on the map. It's not like I can pick up a phone and just call them. Like I was talking to the commander. The commander's gone.
Right.
So you have a commander unit that you have to I had to basically drive over there and get into within like screaming range of these dudes.
Oh, wow.
To like tell them, hey, you need to get your asses out of those woods and take a position in that town because I need like somebody defending it. So
that's fascinating.
Yeah. So it takes like 3 minutes to even get them moving. Even though time is of the essence, it's 3 minutes before I can get their asses like in gear and get them moving toward this objective. And the minute they break the tree line, they start getting like wasted by these Soviet tanks. They get pinned down. They're getting slaughtered. I've basically gotten these guys killed. But before that had all happened, I'd called in helicopter support. And that stuff took like 7 minutes to arrive. These guys are getting like shot to shit in this open field near this town. The last few of them are like trying to return some fire. And before they get wiped out, these two helicopters finally like swoop onto the battlefield. And like within the space of, you know, 2 minutes of just continuous missile fire, they kill like a dozen Soviet tanks and armored personnel carriers. Like, they just show up. It's like the total cavalry moment. These guys, like, streak onto the map. They just open the fuck up. They shoot till their magazines are dry. They turn around and leave. And that squad of infantry is like, they're like, what the hell just happened? Like, it's them alone on this like plane of like burning like trucks, armored vehicles, tanks. It's incredible. And shit like that happens all the time. So it's this really dry looking game.
I was just saying, like, we should like make it clear. Like, there's not a lot aesthetically going on to this game. It is extremely dry. Like, it's not, it is a, you know, top down, you know, it's not grids, you know, it's not hexes, but
it's like a surveyor's map that like has icons on it.
Yes. It looks like a 2D representation, like an overhead 2D representation of like how we would visualize maybe making a 3D battlefield map to get a sense of like what the scale of the world is.
That's where they stopped. That was their quality bar. But like, yeah, what happens in that fucking owns.
That's super cool. All so right, two back-to-back strategy games.
Yeah, that came out and I was like, shit, this is this means some stuff has to get bumped. Which I was happy to do. Any other things that like almost made the list but didn't quite?
Let's see. I think I might have cut that list down entirely. I'm looking at my list from the year. You know, I thought about, I liked Into the Breach a lot. And I really did like it. It was one of those in like the top 15, but, I didn't fall for it the same way everyone else did, which is no fault of that game's own. It was more just, I beat it once and sort of had my fill. I think it speaks to the different qualities of like Mutant Year Zero that like it makes, I often need a little more. I enjoy a little more structure for, like, Into the Breach requires, you need to be interested fundamentally in different unit setups and just the sheer act of repetition and, like, changing that up through that. And I need, like, more of a hook. Like, if there was, like, oh, there's more story to get if you do another set of units and try and beat the game, I could have seen myself playing it again. But I kind of fell by the wayside because, like, once I'd done it once, it's like, oh, okay. Like, I know that's not, I haven't seen all it has to offer, but that's... That was enough for me, whereas with Mutant Year Zero kind of continues to string me along. That's the one that stands out the most as like an almost game.
So I think for me, I was surprised. Like in the end, despite the fact there was so much I did not like about Assassin's Creed Odyssey, like I had to admit,
stuck around.
I ended up really enjoying a lot of my time with that game.
Okay,
and I'm not quite. Done
I'm
with
I'm
it.
Surprised by that, given the way that. You and Austin talked about it early on was like, man, they sure fucked up in not making an actual sequel to Origins.
Well, and I would stand by that. Like, would that game have been better if it was more like Origins in a whole bunch of ways? Probably. But at the same time, it's such a cool, like, dreamy version of, and I mean like dreamlike, not like, oh, it's dreamy. Although Cassandra is pretty dreamy. But... It's more like this really almost dreamlike take on classical Greece that I was really into. It reminded me a lot of like, this is Assassin's Creed doing maybe like a Hollywood sword and sandals movie of the 60s. That's kind of what it is doing in this game. And I was surprised how much I ended up digging that in the end. And it ended up being an experience I really, really enjoyed. Another game that almost made it onto this list, oddly enough, was a... Wailing card tactics game called Nantucket.
Sure.
Which is like a sequel to Moby Dick is how it's positioned.
Okay. Right.
And it was just really good. It's a weird thing. Again, we did a 3 moves ahead on it. I did not expect to like that game that much. But it has a really cool style. It tells a memorable, like, Melville-esque story of whaling and obsession. And god damn, did they record some good sea shanties. That, like, the soundtrack
of that
game.
Oh, you know, that's what I'd heard about that. I know nothing about that game other than someone on Twitter sharing enthusiasm for some fucking sea shanties in that game. And that they, I believe, put out sea shanties DLC. Like, just like, yo, you wanted more shanties? We got them.
Yeah.
That might be why. I think I might have seen that on Reddit or something. Yeah. Or on Twitter. It was just like enthusiasm for the shanties.
And that's no joke. The shanties were great. Like legitimately, like better than Black Flag. Like to be quite honest. That like just better renditions of traditional sailor songs.
The other one, and this maybe leads into another game on my list, is I ended up cutting Moss, which was a game that came out at the beginning of this year, in which you control like a little mouse. It's for PlayStation VR, was at the time. It's on all VR platforms now. And just a really delightful and fun world that like really took advantage of the fact that it recognized sort of strategically what you can do with a camera in VR that is beyond just like you are the camera. Like it has fixed perspectives, almost like you're looking at a diorama and then you're exploring that diorama and controlling this little mouse. And just, you know, the puzzles were fun. Like I had left that experience reminded why I have been and continue to be interested in VR, even if I've often not gone out of my way to play a lot of those experiences once some of the, you know, some of the gimmickiness kind of like wore off after the first year of all that stuff coming out. And that leads into Astrobot, which is on my list and is going to be exceptionally high on my list because I think if this game was made by Nintendo, I think people would be absolutely fucking losing it for it. It is, you know, it's made by Sony, maybe one of their Japanese studios. I don't know what they've worked on in the past, but it is just, it's a really good platformer. It has so much character and life. It is one that recognizes, like Moss, that it's not just trying to take, oh, it's a platformer, and then you're in VR, which is what some early VR platformers were, was just this sense of, like, oh, you're controlling a character, and then you can also, like, look under a bridge that they walk over. And it's like Astrobot recognized, like, no, like, the camera, the head, you know, that you are present in the world should be a tool. It should be something that is recognized by the game. So that's as subtle details as, you know, if you put your head up to a set of flowers, it knows that you're looking at them, and they smile at you. It's more physical, in which, like, you'll be going through a section where the only way for Astrobot to get through is that you need to kind of bash it with your head. And it doesn't overdo that stuff. It doesn't get into gimmick territory. It's more just recognizing that you are there. You are both controlling a character, but the player is also present, and finding ways to integrate that. Like the collectibles, of which I grabbed like 95% of them, because it was delightful to look for them. It understood the spots it was hiding in was like rewarding to like peek around the corner or like bash my arm into my desk because like, oh, maybe it would be in that spot. And I found myself over and over going out of my way to find all the tiny details tucked away, because one of the things that I've always praised Nintendo for is that when they do that extra stuff, they always seem to be mindful of doing so in a way that is respectful of your time and your curiosity, as opposed to just hiding things so that you can checkbox a list. And Astrobot seemed to understand those values really well. And so my sort of constant comparisons to Mario don't come from just a place of it's a convenient analogy. It's more that like the values that Nintendo instills into their platformers, this very much feels like a product of that, of a team that recognized sort of those gold star standards that Nintendo puts into those games and trying to make one of those where VR is a pivotal component. So it's a really, really great game that is super hard to necessarily articulate because so much of VR often feels intangible, or at the very least, when watching a video of it, it just seems so flat in comparison to the sort of lizard brain experience that you have when you actually put on that headset. But I totally recommend it to folks that have fallen off the VR bandwagon or it's collecting dust. Like, I'm one of those people, but it made me a believer again and got me to actually set up a convenient VR spot in my office so that, you know, I can hopefully not miss games like that going forward.
I think on the front of things that, like, it's hard to articulate what makes them special and mm-hmm. things you didn't expect to be, like, so affecting, given that they appear to be, like, just very typical genre stuff at first glance. For me, Forza Horizon 4 ended up being a game.
Yeah, you fucking loved this game.
Yeah, just came out of nowhere. I've never gotten into the Horizon games, so there's an element here of, for whatever reason, this is the first one that really clicked with me. I kind of bounced off too. But I think part of it is, so there's really like a couple components to driving games that I think exist in tension with each other. Like, there's a lot of fun to be had with a, like, serious racing sim, like a Project Cars type game where you're just completely, like, in tune with the machine and trying to wring all the performance you can out of it. And it can be really dramatic and, like, you know, it can be beautiful to play these games, but they can be so absorbing that you're not really given the opportunity to appreciate the beauty of the game. Like, after a certain point, with Project Cars stands out in mind because I viewed that as a beautiful game, but once I started playing it, I noticed the beauty less and less and less because I was so focused on the demanding and absorbing tasks it put before you. Mm-hmm. But when I think about, like, what I enjoy about driving, especially, you know, I'm taking a long road trip with family or something, a lot of it is just driving across the countryside. And, you know, changing light, changing conditions. You never know when you're in a round a bend and just have, like, the most glorious view of the countryside. You just want to stop your car. Forza Horizon 4 captures all of that. Like, it is fun to drive the cars in this game. It gets that stuff right. But maybe more important to me is it is a car game that is about the joy of being in the world that long trips in the car that driving can bring about. Every time, you know, the weather changes and you see, like, a storm coming over the hills, or, you know, you are racing through the woods as, you know, the shadows off the trees are lengthening. Every time it does this stuff, it is just so evocative of place and nature that I found it a really captivating game, despite the fact that everything is wrapped up, almost oppressively so, in this very Forza-esque, like, just make the numbers go up. Everything you do is increasing some bullshit rating, is giving you some sort of space box equivalent. Even though it's doing all of that, all that stuff bounces off me when I'm just so happy to be existing in that world.
Yeah, that's the sense I've gotten from a lot of folks when they've talked about what that game connected with them was for whatever reason, this one specifically, the world was evocative and spoke to them in a way that even if they liked the previous ones, there was something tangibly different about. And I haven't played 4. It's been on my list of, like, man, enough people have talked about that game and it's on Game Pass and I have Game Pass, so I might as well check it out. And so it's one of those games I'm hoping to dive into over the break. But this one in particular, a lot of people have spoken to that world aspect, even if they've had a hard time articulating what exactly this one is doing particularly different. But I think that's been a consistent theme I've heard from a lot of people.
Yeah. I highly recommend you do take a moment to enjoy that over the break. Speaking of breaks, we're going to take one right now, and we'll be back in just a minute here.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
So, out of curiosity, because it can be awkward to do things with this on a list like this, was there anything from not this year that you really got into this year that just sort of stands out for you? I have one thing that I really enjoyed from prior to 2018. This was the year I kind of stumbled across. I had a hankering to play Oxenfree out of nowhere.
Sure, and, I remember that. Yep.
Yeah, and that turns out to have been one of my favorite, like, weekends of the year as a gamer. I spent an entire day just playing through Oxenfree, and I think I might really like the type of writing intensive game that I think it's Night School is the mm-hmm. dev that I enjoy their style of game. And I just wanted to shout out here that, you know, hey, I finally played Oxenfree, and damn, I think that's actually a pretty special game. It is really fun to spend time with those characters, even if some of them do need to shut the hell up. And I highly recommend it. Also really enjoyed their Mr. Robot mobile game, by the way.
Really?
Yeah, they made a pretty good one. Someone recommended it to me after I got into the second season of Mr. Robot. Okay. Turns out they made a really good mobile game set in the middle of season one of Mr. Robot. It's actually really cool. Highly recommended.
There's a couple on my list. Gorogoa, a really terrific puzzle game that had been in development for all sorts of years, in which you're kind of manipulating both the shape structure of like these really intricate, beautiful paintings, and also like tweaking certain values to make sort of these sort of jigsaw puzzle events sort of occur next to each other. This was a game that was a casualty of last December. It came out December 14th, 2017. And it was one of those where I blew through and was like, holy shit, this game blew me away. And I think a lot more people would have been talking about it had it, you know, maybe come out a month or two prior or even just a month later. But I really enjoyed that from 2017. You know, we did our Fortnite this year. That's not one of my favorite games of the year, but it was one of my favorite experiences. And I love that now I can at least articulate what the game is and what's interesting about it. Like, we played enough of it where it's like, I get it. Like, I 100% understand, even if, you know, I didn't really touch it after the fact, although I did buy one battle pass thinking that I was going to spend more time with it. I'm glad that I know what that game is. I enjoyed that game. I like that game. I think I liked it more than most people on the team did. I just didn't have the time to keep on the treadmill, both from a skill perspective and from the, you know, aesthetic unlocking stuff perspective. But I really did like that game. And the other one would be, where is it? I thought I had a third one. Maybe not. Maybe those are the two. Maybe those are the two. I think that's it.
Yeah. In terms of this year, I noticed you and I shared an enthusiasm for one particular game. This damn near became my game of the year.
I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, like I haven't quite finished it. So like, that's where I kind of everything I've seen, I've really loved, and I enjoy so much of what this game is doing. But this was the year I really got into Vampyr, or Vampyre, and I think that game is cool as hell. And I am like, the minute I started playing that, Red Dead Redemption went out the fucking window. Like, I was like starting to warm up to Red Dead Redemption. I'm like, yeah, maybe, you know, maybe you just have to stick with it for like 35, 48 hours and then it'll really pick up. That's what Austin's telling me. You know, you just commit weeks of your life to becoming Arthur Morgan. And if you don't die of old age, that game really takes off.
That game, I've seen so many tweets where people have finished it and they're like, I loved that game, but also thank God it's over. And it's like, that's a weird feeling to have at the end of a video game where you've...
For me,
it's not like a pitch for me to get to it.
When I started playing Vampyre, it just drove home instantaneously for me that I was really playing a lot of Red Dead out of this feeling of obligation of needing to have a reaction to it and to like see something about what it's saying that's worth commenting on. And then I started playing Vampyre and I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to, this game rules. I am like unequivocally loving my time with this and meeting its characters and inhabiting its world. So I'm just going to do that. And I kind of haven't looked back.
It was a game that I remember in the first couple of hours, just not knowing what to make of it. It's a confusing, confounding game for a lot of reasons. I turn it off and then I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And eventually I just came to terms with, you know, if you were to talk about this game in your old school, you know, game pro, like, what does it do well? What does it do poorly? Like, this game doesn't rate very well, right? Like, in like those, like, quote unquote, you know, objective graphics gameplay standards. Like, there's a lot of it that is lacking, but it's just so fucking interesting. And it just goes for it in so many different ways. And the parts that it does get right, it gets really right, or at least its ambitions are so fascinating that I just found myself wrapped up in this world, its characters, It's especially for me rare to say that like 25 to 30 hours just goes by, but that is absolutely, I just ate this game up in like a week and a half in a way that I just do not do with a lot of video games.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, there's all those things you could drag it for a little bit. Some of the voice acting is pretty uneven. I think the main characters are done pretty well, but you're going to meet a lot of incidental characters that are kind of, you know, oi, gov, whatcha, you know, yeah. That kind of thing. The combat is, like, very clumsy Souls imitation.
It's trying.
Yeah, but it's an RPG.
Especially
like it's a plot oriented RPG that like the combat designers were like, yeah, I really like Demon Souls, Dark Souls. Let's.
Do you want to make one? You want to make one of those?
And hey, you like Bloodborne, right? Bloodborne.
We don't have the budget, Joe.
Yeah.
and they went for it.
Just
anyway.
Put a dodge roll in. All right.
And it's one of those things where, like, I actually found the comic to be, like, fine and fulfilling enough in the, like, opening, you know, 5 to 10 hours, and then it sort of just grinds on you in the, especially latter half of the game, to a degree that, for a lot of people, I would just tell them to, I don't know if you can switch to story mode halfway through, but if you could, I would just tell them to, because it's not like it has a progression curve or a skill curve where you're like, man, I'm just really feeling myself on this. It's more just, it just gets harder and more annoying, but it's the reason it didn't matter was because like the world, even like the A plot, like that goes to some interesting places and all the stuff it does with the world, like the different neighborhoods that you're trying to, you know, keep tabs on, even though
it's
that
a game
stuff
about
falls
neighborhoods
apart.
That's the other part of it is like it's this game of like,
it's about a city. Lots of games are set in cities, not a lot of games are about the city. And like, Vampire is a game that is about that city, even though the actual terrain, environment, locations are not super memorable. Like, I constantly found myself going back to areas and being like, I don't know how the fuck to find the thing I mean to find. But it did the most important part, which is, like, the characters and themes of the different neighborhoods came across really well, even if the actual, like, architecture itself left a lot to be desired.
But for the most part, like, it's so cool that the game, one of the, I think this is actually kind of inspired, it explicitly makes doing plot stuff and part, like, puzzling out more stuff about characters core to the experience, right? Like, yes. You can't, like, you could just eat a variety of people. You're a vampire. You could do that. But, like, they'll taste better if you know all their secrets. And
it's such a goofy mechanic, but I fucking love it.
Yeah.
Because it's one of its central mechanics of, like, we're not going to let you eat NPCs or to eat the just, you know, regular, like, enemies to get experience. You're going to have to eat, consume, remove from the world central characters that you've spent hours, maybe a dozen hours with. And even though you know you're going to have to remove some of them from the world, and some of them may not be totally bad, you're just going to have to make a judgment call, because you need to scale up your character to go along with the difficulty. That's maybe something that gets lost in the story mode, right? Like, it's because, like, one of the core tenets of the gameplay is, like, hey, in order to get stronger, you need to make the tough choices on, like, who you're going to take out. But in order to increase the XP that you get from that character, you need to learn more about them. It's stuff like that that it's like, that's just a really smart way. Even if it sounds goofy as hell, it works remarkably well to get you invested in the characters.
It also feels like every neighborhood is like the set of a play that you're sort of taking part in and watching unfold scene by scene each time you visit.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it. You meet a vampire hunter in this game. And the funny thing is, like, he's kind of likable. Like, he's a clown. Mm-hmm. But I just love the way your character kind of interacts with him. Like, yeah, so tell me more about vampires. Like, what do you know? Like, really fascinating. Have you ever actually... If you were talking to a vampire, like, would you know it? Are you sure you know it? It's so good. I love that shit.
Yeah, the main character is kind of an asshole, and they let you lean into that in a couple of different ways, depending on how, like, you basically just, he's an asshole, but you get to choose, like, the level of smug throughout.
What if Gregory House were a vampire?
I mean, honestly, because, like, Gregory House, like, has some level of empathy, and, like, you know, the character you play has empathy, and you can choose to express that in a variety of different ways. But at the end of the day, you're still the game goes out of its way to remind you, like, you're playing kind of an unlikable ass in a way that I enjoyed. I liked the fact that you wasn't an anti-hero. You're kind of just playing sort of a rich, entitled asshole who also can see the plight of others, and it's just a matter of, like, how you scale that character based on your different reactions.
So, Patrick, I was saying that, like, this came damn close to being my game of the year. I couldn't quite put it there, mainly because, like, for me, and we did a podcast on this, Battletech kind of had a lock on that spot for the better part of the year. It sounds like you were in a similar boat with, like, Vampire rating very, very highly, but maybe there's something else that really is tough to dislodge in your personal top best of list.
Yeah, it's sort of between two games. So I had this. Someone texted me last night. Was like, "Hey, I'm going as I'm Christmas vacationing. I need to download a Switch game, Celeste or Dead Cells." And I found myself having a hard time picking between the two. And I thought that spoke. Celeste is a game that came out in January. It's a really terrific platformer that has also a really touching story about mental health at the center of it, and tied explicitly to the gameplay mechanics. Not so much that it's expressing mental health through gameplay mechanics, in so much as, like, the reason you're going on this journey and what's reflected in the level design and the progression is tied to the story it's trying to tell. And I actually found myself, as much as I love Dead Cells, it is one of my favorite games of this year. Like, I found myself falling on recommending Celeste, and then in recommending it, realizing how much, I think the Keeleys were also a part of this, is like reminding me how much I fell for that game and how much more it is than just a good platformer. It is like a transcendent, great game. And so it's kind of between that, Celeste and Hollow Knight. And Hollow Knight's also a game that came out in 2017. It just came out on Switch, and that's where a lot of people, including myself and Natalie and Austin, sort of discovered it. But, if you had to, put a gun to my head right now, like, I wouldn't be shocked if where I end up with is Celeste being sort of my favorite game, because I found myself listening to the soundtrack again, picking it up and, kind of playing with some of the harder levels that I kind of hit a wall with when I was finishing it up earlier this year. Just a really tremendous experience that, calling it a good platformer is a disservice to, like, the other things that it's accomplishing along the way.
You also, what were your other top games? Because I know there were a couple that, you've really gotten into this year.
Yeah. So we, I can kind of punt on getting into them too much because we've done... There's been crossover with the rest of the staff. Monster Hunter World is a game that I had no real affinity for the series, but also like Fortnite, I academically now understand that game and I like it, but didn't fall in love with it. Monster Hunter World, years ago, I academically came to understand, I guess I can see what people see in this and why they get obsessed, but it didn't click for me. And this was the era of Monster Hunter World, I think a huge amount of our staff fell for that at the same time and was playing together. Natalie and Austin and I have a podcast diving deep into Monster Hunter World and why we all fell for that game. Same one with Hollow Knight, also Austin, Natalie, and Patrick joint. And also, the Awesome Adventures of Captain Spirit, which it got rolled into a conversation I had with Kato and Natalie about the first episode of the Life is Strange.
Danielle.
Danielle. Sorry, that's my bad. I was on a lot of podcasts with Natalie, but that one was with Kato and Danielle, in which we talked. That was framed around the first episode of the new season of Life is Strange, which I did like quite a bit. But the Awesome Adventures of Captain Spirit, which is a short story, like a 90 minutes about the relation between a father and son, in which the they have lost, the father has lost his wife, the son has lost his mother to a tragic accident. The father has become bad, shitty. There are suggestions of abuse. There are suggestions, not suggestions, outright neglect in being a parent. And, as someone that, has been a father for, a couple of years now, you know, it's not that I saw myself in that situation, but I found myself so profoundly moved by just the question of like, what would you do if your significant other, if your whole like foundation of your being was just removed from under you, how would you react to that? And I don't know that all of us can confidently say the kind of person we would be if that, if we were put in that position. So I found myself just deeply moved by the story I told of the kid, the story I told of the father. It doesn't try to redeem him. It's more just that situation itself really ended up speaking to me in a way that I was not ready for, nor did I expect, but came away being one of those experiences that I did not soon forget, even after the credits rolled on that one. Let me look at your list because yeah. You have the top of this list, the games that are best, and everything else is just hiding. Okay, I want to make sure we get to this. I want to make sure we get to Valkyria Chronicles because on a previous podcast recorded today, you were like, "Yo, I need to go in on that game." I liked the original. I played like a couple hours of it years ago. Have not gotten to 4 yet, although it's on my Switch and I do want to get to it. But like, why was this one of those games that, you know, still has stuck with you at the end of the year?
That might be hard for you to get. Like, if you kind of bounced off Valkyria Chronicles, you'd...
I didn't bounce. I just didn't... I really loved the first couple of hours and then just shuffled it to the side because of X, Y, and Z. Yeah. I really enjoyed the couple hours I played. I played it when they re-released it on Steam, when they did the PC version. I just haven't had a chance to play more of that and or get to 4.
So if you want to hear us be, like, fully on our bullshit about Valkyria Chronicles 4... you should listen to the 3 Moves Ahead I did with Austin and Heather Alexandra from Kotaku. But I think the short version is Valkyria Chronicles 4 does a really good job of giving you the sense of a vastly expanded scope for Valkyria Chronicles. Like, if Valkyria Chronicles is largely, oh, you're kind of the Special Forces Adventure Squad, and it's this cutesy, like, everybody there was kind of found themselves caught up. Like, you're a couple small-town kids who took the family tank to war against, like, the Soviet German Empire or whatever. That's kind of Valkyria Chronicles 1. Valkyria Chronicles 4 is... you're now kind of part of this massive, ambitious invasion of the like Soviet German Empire, and you're still from like a small, peaceful nation, but you are definitely like on the attack, and you are definitely like invading someone else's like national homeland, and it feels like it. There are so many good moments where you get this sense of, this is not happening at this like really small, intimate scale. You are part of something much, much larger. There are just massive, like, there's this series of 3 missions where you are breaching basically the Empire's frontier defenses. And it is just an absolute hellscape of like burning tanks, you know, shattered barbed wire trenches, pillboxes. And you have to navigate all that with your squad. And there are more things that make the battlefield bigger than it's ever been before. Like, for instance, now there's multiple missions where you will command multiple tanks, where you will have armored vehicles. That their huge advantage is that they can bring entire groups of troopers across in one move, and you deploy them elsewhere. So it encourages a lot more like creativity about ways you can attack the map. Like, this is still fundamentally a game where the scenarios are throwing puzzles at you and you can try different solutions. But the sense that there's much greater space for like ingenuity is one of the things that really got me on board with Valkyria Chronicles 4. There's so many missions where I'm like, wait, I think there's an entirely different way I can conceive of this mission that will turn it on its head and give me a better rating when I finish the mission. And that's just a really cool thing to have.
How much, I mean, that game is anime. How much did you find yourself falling for any of that stuff? Or was it largely the tactics part and the setting, the characters, are kind of take it or leave it?
Okay. I have a weird relationship with anime.
Mm-hmm.
And we get into this a little bit on that podcast I referenced. Austin gives his greater theory of what anime is, what is anime, and how do we relate to it. I think there is a comfortable form. There is a comfortable formal structure to a lot of anime genres that, even though I roll my eyes and I can find them corny and it can be very paint by numbers and you almost like know the exact beat for beat, like rundown of how a scene is going to play out, how the arc of a relationship is going to play out, it is still very satisfying to see that pay off. And that can be translated to a lot of different settings, like invading an analog for, the Soviet Union / Germany in the 40s. And so even though this game definitely has some real issues with anime stock characters and some that just seem like sort of the cutesy throwaway misogyny you find in a lot of mm-hmm. anime. There's one character that has a couple bad beats around stuff like that. I am still fundamentally able to let myself be charmed by Valkyria Chronicles 4 because I like that form. I like that structure. And there's something comfortable and reassuring about, you know, seeing these kids just learn to trust each other, believe in themselves, and go kill some fascists with their friend, the dog, the squad dog. So, I mean, that's
his name? Just the
no,
dog?
No, his name, God. Rat? I don't remember the dog's name.
Didn't mean that much to you, I guess.
He's a, yeah, probably not. But look, he has a little hat. He's cute. Don't worry about it.
Fair.
Dog rules.
Okay, so I got to roll out of here in like a couple of minutes, but we probably need another 20 or so to like really put a pin on this.
Your kids with your mom, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, basically you're fine, right? Like what's...
Well, no, she has an appointment. And so I need to go relieve her of her duties and go get her.
Otherwise she'll just leave Jessica. Here, kid.
She may be, I don't know when she started her nap. Like, she could be sleeping for 2-3 hours this afternoon. So I will bring a microphone with me. And so maybe why don't you go break for lunch, and then maybe I can find a spot for
or us we to can, or we can rap. Afternoon. Like, it's really up to you.
I guess we don't have to go.
There's only a couple more game, that, like, right? I would hit. Like, I talked about Sea of Thieves on another podcast. Sea of Thieves ended up being an unlikely rock star of the year. Tetris Effect, I think if anything, you guys undersold it on the podcast where you initially talked about it. Like, that is a sensory delight mm-hmm. that totally fucked me up. It is a very powerful experience.
Let's see, what else did I have?
Well, you're going to be with your daughter. Talk to me about those dad feelings. Talk to me about God of War.
Yeah. I mean, that was a game that I think I wrote about in my review that, like, I had trouble not viewing through the lens of sort of, I mean, Kratos, you know, bad person, bad character, like, arguments can be credibly made for there's no reason to even try and find a way to redeem that character, like, given all the scope of storytelling we could do, given the budgets and that could be assigned to telling new kinds of stories, like, why do we need to find a way to bring Kratos back from the brink? And I think those arguments have a lot of credibility, but I couldn't help but look at that game and constantly think about the relationship with my own father, who as most people know, like, passed away, a number of years ago to an heart attack at an early age. He was just 56, and had a good relationship with my dad, but we never quite graduated from father-son to the sort of more unequals that seems to happen as kids and parents get older. Like, I always looked forward to that happening, figured, like, there's an arc to this. Like, well, okay, I got married, I'm going to buy a house, I'll have a kid, like, my dad will retire, like, there'll just be more time for those moments to happen. And I always knew that my dad loved me, but he never said any of that stuff. He showed it through his actions. But there was just a lot sort of unsaid that I wished we would have had time for. And I there's so much of God of War that is about a man struggling to be vulnerable, to tell his son how he feels about him. He shows through his actions of gutting dragons and, you know, other all sorts of creatures and through violence to show how he cares and wants to find a better path for that person. But I couldn't help but play that game and constantly think about how, okay, that's what I want to avoid with my kid. Like, I don't want that feeling to go unsaid. I mean, there'll always be things that are unsaid. There'll be always be a lack of resolution with that sort of thing. But I don't want that to be one of them. And so, I mean, outside of the way, I think they like successfully reinvented the combat and I liked the world and I think it was beautiful and it was a lot of fun to play. Constantly in that game, what landed for me was that specific relationship and how I just try to think through that in my own life. Probably distractingly so. I mean, because that game treats its women like real shitty and they're only plot points. In a way that is, you know, more broadly representative of how God of War has treated women. And yet I always found myself coming back to that bit and unable to let it go. And that's most of my list.
Spider-Man.
Dead Cells is really good.
Spider-Man was on my list. The weird thing is I enjoyed the shit about like being Peter Parker and dealing with his fucking dumpster fire of a life, though. Also, I got really frustrated with, like, man, you are really being a drag on everybody around you, dude. Like, at a certain point, I was like, Peter, like, you need to stop fucking up. Like, do some Robin Hood shit and pay your rent, man. Don't, like, don't go crashing at Mary Jane's. God damn it.
That shitty part of his character is part of what I found appealing. Like, it was just a different kind of Peter Parker, while still feeling very much Peter Parker. That game at the end of the day is the swinging for me. Like, the sensation of getting around that world that was one. I mean, the intro of that game where he puts on the suit, jumps out of the building, and you're just immediately in it was breathtaking. Yep. I think about that sequence all the time. I don't know if I've had a game start better and immediately show you, here's what's good about this game. This is the core. I mean, the combat's fine, whatever. It's you know, a faster Arkham Asylum. It does its job, but like in the first 30 seconds, you get a sense of that character in its apartment and what kind of a slob he is, and then immediately get this incredible feeling of getting around that city that in 30 seconds I was like, oh shit, okay, I'm sold. And that's always the part I go back to in that game.
I probably just needed slightly fewer open worldy nonsense tasks to deal with, but like I really enjoyed the narrative it was laying out. I wish if it hadn't been so like loosey-goosey and so full of like stuff to do, I think I wouldn't have fallen off it as much, is kind of where I ended up. Always trying to relearn exactly what the fuck all the control schemes were.
I want to go back to the DLC, and that's the part that I'm like so worried about the most, is like I just don't know how I'm gonna. I'm sure the DLC is like anything else where it's like it's slightly more difficult than the main game because, hey, you spent time here. And it's like, what if I've been gone for 4 months?
Last two things I'll mention is Northgard is a really great RTS game that came out this year. It also released some great free DLC. We did a 3 moves ahead on it. It's something special. It's so different from a lot of other RTSs that, like, if you immediately hear RTS and think, like, that's not my shit, Northgard doesn't really map to any of those. It's completely its own thing, and it's a very cool thing and very easy to get up to speed on. So really enjoyed that. Obra Dinn, initially I thought was going to finish very highly on my list. We mentioned...
Seems like it didn't quite land for you, based on what I saw in our Discord.
Yeah, I got super into the solving of the mystery, and, like, I knew I was lost to this game when I was, like, you know, bust out the notebook and, like, was reconstructing timelines and who is where during a critical scene. That stuff was really great. Once the pieces begin to fall into place, you begin solving the mystery very, very quickly, and there is less to that story overall than initially it appears. Like, what you get is a very rough outline of what happened in this like pulp nautical adventure, and there's no real like. There's some information they keep secret from you, and I kept expecting that would be like a whole new thing that makes all this resonate a lot more. It really doesn't. It really didn't land that much for me at all. And the other part that like did kind of bother me is. Dude, I spent a lot of time part of that game, a lot of that game, like brute forcing solutions to its puzzles, by just like put a couple characters that I was roughly confident about how they died and when. And then I would just start guessing different Chinese dudes. Like, that was the thing, is like the Chinese and like South Asian characters in this game aren't really characters. They're just like hands on the ship. And they're
just props.
Yeah. And their story kind of goes untold. And it kind of really drove it home for me when, like, I'm just basically process of elimination, like, just trying different combos with these characters.
Until you get the jingle that tells you you got
yeah.
right.
Yeah, and, like, that's always happening around these, like, non-white European characters. That didn't yeah. sit great with me. And you'd say, right. like, maybe that's the point. May or may not be the point. The game doesn't seem to directly comment on it. But it did mean that there's tons of people on this boat. There's only so many characters, fewer than initially appears. And that ended up, like, still a great experience. Didn't yeah. end up finishing particularly high on my list.
Yeah, I think the last one I would say, just very quickly, is Dead Cells, which, you know, if you want to know how I feel about that game, go watch those streams that I did for a week. And then the last stream that I did where Austin
shit the bed,
and Natalie
basically.
Jumped in. Yes. But I don't... there's not a game on this list where I responded as... The word visceral has been destroyed, but I viscerally responded to the mechanical nature of that game in a way that I did not to any other game on this list. Like, it was extremely my shit in the world of Spelunkies and Dark Souls, and that I just, every time I played that game, I was just going fuck in a way that the way it was built was just so deeply satisfying to play. Like, there are all sorts of games on this list where it's like, oh, the world, the characters, and what it's trying to do, and it's like, nah, like, this game just felt so goddamn good to beat the shit out of things, and that is 100% what I resonated with.
All right, that will do it for this podcast, and that will do it for, I think, just about all the Game of the Year stuff, podcast stuff that Waypoint is doing. We still have some other podcasts coming, but I think that is basically us done. It's certainly us done for the week. We are finally done mm-hmm. with this podcasting marathon we've been doing for almost 2 weeks now. Thank you for sticking with us this year. Thanks for listening to us, and hopefully you've enjoyed us more than you've loathed us. Apologies for our bad takes. Our thanks to Too Mellow for the music we've been using throughout this Game of the Year stuff. You can find all that Too Mellow makes at TooMellowMakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney, and you can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Patrick, where can people find you?
At Patrick Klumpik.
All right. So that concludes this Waypoint One-on-One. Hope you've enjoyed listening to me and Patrick work through our game feelings. We will see you in 2019, and we hope you'll join us again. But until then, Raiders sign Nate Peterman.
Bear down.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.